Coming up on Fronteras, medical debt affects one in four families in America, and many will continue to experience financial burdens despite increased access to health insurance under the Affordable Care Act.
We're going to have a lot of ill, very low-income people who are going to be in this situation, trapped in a situation that they didn't choose and they cannot get out of.
Fronteras looks at access to health care and medical debt in the second of a two-part series. Tourists love the hot springs bath in the town of Truth or Consequences, New Mexico.
It's really relaxing. It's soft and it's gentle, and it's taking a bath in Mother Earth.
But just how plentiful are these waters? We'll take a look. But first, the news. This is Fronteras, a journalism project that covers the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and the rising Latino demographic. Fronteras was created through an unprecedented multimedia collaboration among several public radio stations. I'm Crystal Chavez. An ongoing battle between a drug cartel and vigilante groups in Mexico's Michoacán state is sending residents fleeing to the U.S.-Mexico border. Many are seeking asylum in the U.S., but as Jill Replogle reports, Tijuana's migrant shelters are full of those who've been turned away.
I'm standing in the patio of the Madre Asunta shelter for migrant women and children in Tijuana. There are a lot of kids here. They're pretty rowdy this afternoon, and there are women sitting around on chairs, some of them talking on the phone. Many of the women here are from Michoacán, and many of them have already gone to the border to seek asylum and have ultimately been told that they don't qualify.
Mi nombre es Rosa.
Here I met Rosa. She says she came with her four children to ask for political asylum because of everything that's happening in Michoacán. But unfortunately, she says, things aren't the way she thought. Rosa isn't this woman's real name. She and the other women I spoke to at Madre Asunta didn't want to give their names and didn't want photos taken for fear of retaliation against them or their families. They say that retaliation could come from any side in the ongoing battle for control in Michoacán. There, about 300 miles west of Mexico City, the Knights Templar drug cartel is fighting local vigilante groups and Mexican police and soldiers. In this video taken in the town of Nueva Italia in mid-January, armed men in white t-shirts crouch behind a food cart in a park while a gun battle rages nearby. Families fleeing Michoacán began showing up in Tijuana around October of last year, but the numbers have swelled in the first months of 2014, says Mari Galvan. She's a social worker at the Madre Asunta shelter. There are days when six families arrive, each mom with three to four kids, she says. The shelter's 45 beds have been consistently full in recent weeks, Galvan says, full of women trying to figure out their next move after learning they don't qualify for asylum in the U.S. Rosa and her four kids first went to the San Ysidro port of entry on February 1st. She says she asked the immigration officers if they could help give her political asylum for her son. He's 15 years old, and those are the boys they're taking, she says, both the comunitarios and the templarios. The comunitarios are the vigilantes. The templarios are those who work for the drug cartel. Residents say both groups are forcibly recruiting young men into their ranks. But Rosa was turned back at the U.S. border.
The standards are pretty tight. Mexico is not a country from which we grant asylum easily.
This is Jan Joseph Bejar. He's an immigration lawyer in San Diego. In fiscal year 2012, immigration judges granted asylum to only 1% of applicants from Mexico, 126 people. But some asylum seekers from Michoacán have gotten across the border. They've been given the chance to present their case before a judge, and most are allowed to live freely in the U.S. until their asylum case is resolved. The fact that most will eventually be deported is a detail that seems to have gotten lost in the rumor mill. Rosa says she has a lot of friends and family members who have left, and now they're in the U.S. Many have gone to Chicago, Los Angeles, Fresno. Bejar, the immigration lawyer, says these kinds of rumor mills are gold mines for fraudsters. Recent news reports have suggested that people in Mexico are charging migrants for documents they say could help them win an asylum case. The women I talked to at the shelter said no one had defrauded them, but they had sold most of their possessions and borrowed money to make the trip north. When I met Rosa, she had yet to figure out her next move. It turns out two of her four children are American citizens, and when she got to the border, she was able to hand them over to relatives living in Los Angeles.
Me negaron de estar con ellos.
She says the immigration officers wouldn't let her be with her girls. But she admits that she made the decision to leave them at the border. She says it's better for them. She knows they're safe, and she plans to leave them there until there's an end to the turmoil in Michoacan. Reporting from Tijuana, I'm Jill Replogle.
One in four families in America currently faces medical debt. The Affordable Care Act aims to curb issues with health care access and in turn lessen debt. But in an Obamacare America, some populations continue to be barred from access and could still be facing mounting bills. In the second of a two-part series, Tristan Ottone reports.
Maria Cabrera owed $57,000 after she suffered a heart attack and ended up in an Albuquerque hospital.
Oh, yes, que no.
Once I was out of the hospital, I got completely in debt. The debt was so large that I don't even know what's going on.
A large amount of that debt was cut down through financial assistance. But she says the debt collectors are still calling, and she's unclear of just how much she owes.
It's more difficult to live with this situation than it would be if I would have died and it all would have ended. I wouldn't have to deal with this. Living in debt that's so high and living with such a difficult situation.
Viviendo con esta situación tan fuerte.
Cabrera's story isn't uncommon, but the twist here is her immigration status. She's in the country legally, with documents, but has been waiting for her green card for almost 13 years. Because of her status, she's ineligible for Medicaid and can't work. That means she can't pay her bills. Kate O'Donnell is Maria's medical debt case manager.
I don't want to downplay the importance of the Affordable Care Act and expanded Medicaid. It's going to provide care to a lot of people. But still, in Bernalillo County, we are going to have this incredible gap.
O'Donnell is a promotora, or health outreach worker, in Albuquerque.
We're going to have a lot of ill, very low-income people who are going to be in this situation, trapped in a situation that they didn't choose, and they cannot get out of.
An estimated 60,000 residents in New Mexico continue to lack access to affordable health care because they can't afford a cheap plan on the exchange or because of their immigration status.
I don't anticipate the number of clients that I serve going down. I anticipate it going up. I don't anticipate being out of a job anytime soon, ever.
Rachel Garfield is a senior researcher for the Kaiser Family Foundation.
The population that a lot of people are focusing on is the population that is undocumented immigrants, because these individuals are not eligible for any assistance under the law. And in some states, that accounts for a notable share of the uninsured population.
It's estimated that some 85,000 undocumented immigrants live in New Mexico. Across the Southwest, more than 4.5 million. Which means even as the Affordable Care Act rolls out, a sudden illness for many will mean medical debt. And more debt means other problems, according to both Garfield and O'Donnell.
The main reason that people say that they postpone care is because of the cost of care.
Clients who have medical debt are less willing to go to the doctor again for a different treatment, and also to continue the treatments that they have been prescribed.
Like O'Donnell's client, Maria Cabrera.
There are appointments I don't go to anymore. They just pile up more debt and I don't want to go anymore. There are times when I just play deaf when I get calls reminding me that I have an appointment. I don't want to go anymore. It just adds more debt.
Cabrera says she wakes up every morning and searches for some form of work so she can pay her bills. But the collections agencies keep calling and she keeps waiting for her green card so she can finally gain access to health care. In Albuquerque, I'm Tristan Ottone.
More Fronteras coming up. Tourists love the hot springs bath in the town of Truth or Consequences, New Mexico.
It's taking a bath in Mother Earth.
How plentiful are these waters? We'll take a look. Stay tuned. This is Fronteras. I'm Crystal Chavez. Valentine's Day gives us the opportunity to pause and celebrate the people we love. But why not include the things we love, the things that make us who we are? That's what Fronteras commentator Yvette Benavides does as she celebrates her love for Spanish and English.
Growing up on the border in Laredo, Texas, I was immersed in the Spanish language. We had full access to Mexican stations on our black and white television with the antenna askew and wrapped in an amorphous ball of aluminum foil. In the kitchen where my mother cooked, or while my father worked in the yard, the AM radio played tinny cumbias, the constant overlay of static, its off-tempo accompaniment. This was home. English was for school. I wrote poetry and read voraciously. I never wavered from the goal of becoming an English teacher. I was born for it. I also felt incomplete. In university in Austin, I was the only Mexican-American English major in my cohort. I might spot a paisano in the cavernous auditoriums where I took biology or math. We blended in there, embryonic freshmen developing, figuring out who we were. A mix-up in my schedule that first semester landed me in a linguistics class. I didn't even know what the course was about, but the professor, a youthful brunette who wore jeans and sneakers and smelled of clove cigarettes, told us to skip the honorific and call her Amy. She put us at ease. Amy was from New York City, had lived in Jakarta, and was fluent in Indonesian. She taught us that linguistics is about describing, not the prescribing we do, say, when we correct grammar in an English class. This linguistic precept was something new and fascinating. One day in class, the lesson was code switching, a term I'd never heard before in all of my 17 years. It means switching back and forth between two languages. Amy, with eyes smiling, said, "Yvette, I imagine you've done some code switching, right?" I offered an answer. I gave the example of being in the kitchen with my mother cooking the Sunday feast, a menu that included frijoles, arroz, salsa, and tortillas. Juan Gabriel's syrupy song stylings were ubiquitous there. Our house in Laredo, a house my father built with tools for which I only knew the Spanish names, was the place where code switching took place. Yes. All the students stared at me. Even the ones who always participated and seemed far more eloquent than I looked at me and smiled with something like admiration on their faces. One girl wished aloud that she were bilingual. The Spanish language doesn't always enjoy the passionate attention some of us give to it, but I love it as much as the memories of dancing with my mother in the kitchen while she sang along to a balada, playing escuelita with my siblings on summer mornings, piscando naranjas and working in the jardín with my abuelito, or listening to my father read the lectura in la misa del domingo. I love it as much as Solamente Una Vez, the wedding song my husband dedicated to me. I love it as much as the face of my child when I say, te quiero mucho.
Oh, that was Fronteras commentator Yvette Benavides.
Solamente una vez, amé la vida. Solamente una vez.
The southern New Mexico town of Truth or Consequences not only has a funny name, but a funky history. Originally, the town was called Hot Springs, named for the ancient mineral water that bubbles beneath its downtown. Early settlers braved Apache raids to soak in these so-called healing waters. Today, the town's economy is built around them. But as Monica Ortiz Uribe reports, locals have begun to worry about the abundance of their precious natural resource.
This is the water that draws most visitors to Truth or Consequences. At a local hotel, visitors soak in outdoor pools that sit on the bank of the Rio Grande River and overlook a mountain shaped like a turtle shell. The temperature of the water usually hovers above 100 degrees.
It's really relaxing. It's soft and it's gentle and it's taking a bath in Mother Earth.
Jessica Weiner loves this water. After a soak, her skin glows with a pink hue. She's been coming here for the past 16 years. The first time was by chance, on a road trip with a friend.
I didn't even want to come, you know, like the name of the town, Truth or Consequences. It, like, you know, weirded me out.
Hello there. We've been waiting for you. It's time to play Truth or Consequences.
It is a weird name. It comes from this 1950s TV game show. For its 10-year anniversary, host Ralph Edwards promised to broadcast the show from the first town that agreed to change its name to Truth or Consequences.
Here I hereby christen the city of some 8,000 people, Truth or Consequences, New Mexico. Let it...
Today, locals call the town T or C for short. It got its start in the early 1900s when a huge federal dam project started construction nearby. Weary workers would venture 5 miles from their base to seek out women and booze in the tiny outpost. After the dam was completed in 1916, people stuck around for the hot mineral water. In 1937, President Roosevelt funded a hospital here where children with polio received therapy in a giant pool. These days, downtown TRC is dotted with locally owned hotel spas that feature in-house mineral baths, like this one at the Charles Motel. It's in a 70-year-old bathhouse named after a soldier who died in World War II. Kathy Clark is the owner.
And in my estimation, this is some of the best water in the world. It's got 36 different minerals and compounds in it.
These bathhouses contribute nearly half of the city's lodgers tax. A decade ago, when the economy was stronger, outside interest in the town began to grow.
People were moving here from New York, from back east, from California. And so there was a small, like, 4 or 5 year period of a boon here.
The number of well permits suddenly spiked from a few dozen to 150. That's when locals began to worry. Juan Fuentes is the city manager.
There were some wells out in the community that were either not producing how they used to produce. So there was a concern about what was happening to the aquifer.
In 2012, the city issued a moratorium on future well permits and commissioned a study led by hydrologist Mark Persson of New Mexico Tech University. He didn't find a problem with the water quantity, but did discover that not everyone was keeping track of how much water they used.
We were somewhat concerned that they might be using almost all of the potential geothermal fluids.
That's a problem, he says, especially as outside interest in the town continues to grow. Consider the mild climate, the low-cost housing, and even the New Age medicine appeal. Here's local historian Sherry Fletcher.
Sometimes it's better to soak in the mineral baths and have a massage than it is to take a handful of pills that may end up adversely impacting your liver.
Last year, billionaire Ted Turner, founder of the TV news network CNN, bought one of the largest hotels in the hot water district. And 20 miles south of town, a multi-million-dollar commercial spaceport is under construction. The city of TRC is currently drafting new regulations that would expand their water monitoring efforts in the hopes of better protecting a unique resource central to their identity. Monica Ortiz Uribe, reporting from Truth or Consequences, New Mexico.
Congress set aside $125 million in the new farm bill to help fight a crippling attack on the nation's citrus trees. Greening disease has already cost the Florida citrus industry billions, and Southern California researchers want to keep it out of that state's commercial groves. Eric Anderson reports from San Diego that a tiny imported wasp is helping growers wage war on a bug that spreads the disease.
The Palma Valley cuts across the top of San Diego County, running from the mountains to the coast. Four generations of Lyles have farmed here, but Andy Lyle worries that's about to change. He says the tiny Asian citrus psyllid is laying siege to his livelihood.
They'll land on that leaf, and they have a sharp mouth part that they literally poke into the leaf and suck the fluid out. And in the process, then, they can infect that tree just like with a hypodermic needle.
The infection is untreatable and fatal. Citrus greening, or Huanglongbing disease, is already ravaging Florida's groves, costing farmers there billions. San Diego County entomologist Tracy Ellis says the insect that spreads the disease, the Asian citrus psyllid, is already here in force.
Whenever the insect arrives, the disease quickly follows. It was a 5-year gap between Florida's detection of the ACP and then its detection of the disease.
The illness has officially only been found in a tree in Los Angeles County. Mark Huddle is an entomologist at UC Riverside. He suspects the local situation is more dire.
Given the vast numbers of citrus trees growing in Southern California, it is highly likely there are many other trees in residential areas that have the disease, but we just have not found them yet. But it is likely that the psyllid has found those trees that are infected. It has acquired the bacteria, and it is now spreading it to more and more healthy trees.
That's why entomologists are attacking the Asian citrus psyllid that spreads the illness. Huddle says a small wasp from Pakistan is proving to be a capable foot soldier.
They attack the nymphs, or the immature stages of the psyllid, and the females lay their eggs inside these nymphs. Those parasite eggs hatch, and then a tiny larva that looks like a little fly maggot just slowly eats the inside of the nymph, eventually killing it.
Extensive testing during an 18-month quarantine suggests the psyllid is the only food the wasp is interested in. Without psyllids, the wasps die out. And Huddle says they are very effective at seeking out and finding their prey. But a big challenge is raising enough wasps to have an impact. Part of that work happens at UC Riverside. Huddle says the work is slow.
We have to grow a citrus plant. Then on that citrus plant, we need to grow the Asian citrus psyllid. Then on those, we need to put the parasites which attack the Asian citrus psyllid. And then about 10 days later, the parasites will hatch out of those parasitized nymphs. Then we have crews of people that are collecting those parasites out of the mass rearing cages.
Even in this small 15-square-foot breeding room, researchers can still raise 6 to 10,000 wasps a week. Huddle says they use a nozzle attached to a vacuum tube to suck them out of the boxes. From there, they go into small vials.
We just open the lid. You can see that little piece of paper that has the honey on it that the parasites feed on. And then when that vial is hanging in the tree, the parasites come out.
But Southern California is a huge region. Huddle says just raising enough of the predators to be effective is a major challenge. And there are other obstacles. Grace Radabaugh is a California Department of Agriculture technician. She says the psyllids are getting help from Argentine ants.
The psyllid, the Asian citrus psyllid nymphs, are producing this sugary substance called honeydew. And when that honeydew is produced, the ants find it. And they feed on it and they take it back to their nest. And it's a food source for them.
And the ants will fight the Pakistani wasps and other threats to keep that sweet food on the menu. Researchers say the best thing that backyard gardeners can do to help control the psyllid is to focus energy on controlling Argentine ants. Meanwhile, San Diego County farmers like Andy Lyle regularly inspect their groves. They do what they can with pesticides, and they hope researchers find a way to stop the illness before it shows up in a commercial grove. In San Diego, I'm Eric Anderson.
That's it for Fronteras, a journalism project that covers the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and the rising Latino demographic. Fronteras is a collaboration of public radio stations KNAU Flagstaff, KRWG Las Cruces, KNPR Las Vegas, KJZZ Phoenix, KPBS San Diego, KUAZ Tucson, KXWT West Texas Public Radio, KRTS Marfa, and KSTX San Antonio. This theme music was composed by Charanga Cakewalk. I'm Texas Public Radio's Crystal Chavez. Thanks for listening.